Again, welcome to you all. This is from Scotland and from Dr. Matthew Fox in California. We're here today to speak for a brief bit together about some of the work that's, I think, dearest to our hearts, which has to do with the human, you could say what's called human potential, the greater human potential, and how that's revealed by some of the books we've written, particularly Matt's Cosmic Christ books and my Aramaic Jesus books. Let me just say a word about Matthew Fox first, for those of you that may not know him very well. I've known him for many, many years and had the blessing, I can easily say the blessing, to work in his Institute in Creation Spirituality in Oakland in the 1980s. Matt is not only a writer and author of, well, I think nearly 40 books now, but also an educator. His whole model of education is really the way that many of us feel that education needs to go. That is, education of the whole person, not only the secular materialist person. In addition, Matt has had many dialogues with various scientists. He's written books on work, also on spiritual activism, and recently, within the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, formed the Order of Sacred Earth, which is a guild of sacred activism. So today we're going to be speaking more about, you could say, Jesus and Cosmic Christ. And in particular, as I mentioned in the announcement, we had books come out 30 years ago, almost within a few months of one another. And then we've updated that work over the years. Matt's work with Ritual was updated with through the Cosmic Christ with a book called Stations of the Cosmic Christ, which takes the whole image of Stations of the Cross, where one would follow, you could say symbolically or in imagination, the Via Dolorosa of Jesus on his last journey, and changes that over to the Stations of the Cosmic Christ, which is really about, you could say, okay, let's meditate and view through, imagine ourselves in the position of, you could say, Jesus in these various transmissional moments, I think we could call them, from the standpoint of spirituality, where he's transmitting something greater than just, you could say, a belief or a concept to people. And he's trying to communicate to them something that we'll talk about, Cosmic Christ. And my own book, my own recent book, which is coming out in a couple of weeks, Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus, updates my work since that time also. And I think, you know, one of the impetuses for this is that Matt was gracious enough to introduce my new book. And then I thought, well, really, this new book really brings these two together, Cosmic Christ and historical, so to speak, historical Jesus. Many people, particularly liberal Christians, have had an aversion to the historical Jesus because there's so much confusion about this. And I think, as my new book shows, there doesn't need to be confusion about historical Jesus. We don't have to have warring theories about, was he a Mediterranean Jewish peasant or a cynic philosopher, and on and on and on. If we simply view him as a prophetic figure, speaking prophetic words, and view him through his not only his native language, Aramaic, but also through the worldview of that time, the cosmogony, the origins of the world, and also the cosmology, which is very important, that modern culture has really lost both its cosmology, its bigger picture of life, as well as where it came from. And so if you lose where you've ultimately come from, you're going to lose where you're going too. I mean, let's face it. So Matt, let me welcome you officially, formally, after I've had these few words, and really blessed to have you here. And thanks for sharing this time with us.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's wonderful to be with you all. And our understanding is over 1,200 people have registered for this class. Of course, many are in different time zones, so they'll tune in by video or film later. But it's good to be with you all, and I'm excited about the obvious interest in this topic. And I'm very excited about Neil's new book, and I was honored to write a foreword to his very first book, the Aramaic Jesus, and where he translated the Our Father and the Beatitudes into Aramaic. And now this is his most recent book. And I was asked again to do a foreword, and I'm very honored by that. And in my foreword, I really stressed what a revolutionary contribution Neil has made his whole life long. Because, as he says, really, talking about the historical Jesus is not enough. We have to talk about the Aramaic historical Jesus and the language that Jesus spoke and dreamed in and thought in. And that includes, of course, the cosmology. Our views of the world are sifted to us through our cosmologies and our languages. So what Neil has been doing is very, very important. And I said in my very first foreword many years ago that his translation of Our Father was a revolutionary book. And now I can say the same about his most recent book, which is a wonderful summary of his life's work. So I really honor what Neil has been doing. And it's not just about words either. He dances, he creates rituals. He's put the Aramaic Jesus into body prayer and into circle dancing and all the rest. And this is part of overcoming the dualisms of Western languages and Western education and Western thinking, that your more tribal languages. And I've had the blessing to work a lot with Native American peoples, but they are so much more together and so much more playful. And as he points out, Neil, in his work, like in the translation of the Our Father, there are actually seven different ways to translate each sentence in the Our Father. But that's because unlike Latin and Greek and English and German and all this, these more ancient and down-to-earth languages, they play with languages. And you hear this from African speakers and other indigenous people as well. So I really honor Neil's work. And I think the focus we've chosen for today is not only very interesting and exciting, it's very important. I would say that, as Neil was referring to, but my language would be that our species is on a cusp today. Either we wake up and grow up, or our extinction is most probable. And so we have to go back to our great teachers, as well as call forth the great thinking of our own communities today, including our science, to stir up our passion. And so much of that's what I like about Neil's writing, that he takes these prayers that have become prayers by rote, like the Our Father, and he puts life back into them, not by making things up, but by going back to the original language. So one of the points I did in my introduction to his book, or forward to it, I was really amused by, but struck by. I went to Webster's Dictionary, because I was thinking, you know, we're so used to prayers by rote. So I looked up learning by rote in the Webster's Dictionary, and this is what it said. It said, learning by rote means the use of memory, usually with little intelligence, or it means routine or repetition carried out mechanically and unthinkingly, or it means a joyless sense of order, and it means a commercial hustle. If that isn't a summary of what some people experience as religion today, I don't know what it is. But I was just blown over by Webster's Dictionary. I'm serious, it's not that exciting, but this took the top of my head off. Memory with little intelligence, mechanical, unthinkingly routine, joyless sense of order, and a commercial hustle. I don't think that's where we want to be on the cusp of a new version of humanity. Humanity is supposed to grow up, not fall asleep, and bore one another and call it religion. Okay, so now we're getting into the cosmic Christ. And
yeah, let's do that, you know, because, you know, we're you know, the world is filled with confusion, some of the old order seems to be breaking down, or what was the old order for the last 100 years. Here, as we mentioned when we were off camera, you know, the queen just died, and people feel, whatever you feel about monarchy, that she was sort of a linchpin figure. We don't have to look very far to see around us, you know, war, the rise of white right-wing dictatorship, fascist tendencies, even in countries like the U.S. Matt, in terms of ritual, I mean, many people consider ritual irrelevant. Why bother with ritual? Can we talk about that a little bit, and then we'll go into cosmic Christ? Why do you think ritual is so important for us?
Well, ritual, as Melodome Somi wrote, he died recently, the great African teacher of ritual, who was instructed by his elders to come to America and teach Americans about ritual. As he says, there is no community without ritual, period. There's no community without ritual. And exactly the issues that Neil just named, including obviously climate change, is an issue of community, isn't it? And communities falling apart all around us. And of course, the community around humans and networking with the rest of creation, what Hildegard of Bingen called the web of creation. This is about survival, not just our survival, but the survival of the beauty and the diversity of nature as we know it at this time in history. And so we need all the tools we can get to build a broader sense of community in a deeper sense that is more than just human community, more than just the little tiny boxes we find ourselves in, whether as Europeans or Americans or Asians or North Koreans or South Koreans or what have you. We always tend to that tribalism. And we have to be thinking in terms of our common survival. And this is what you do in ritual. You celebrate common joy. You know, whatever our difference is, we're here. And isn't that something to be joyful about? And you celebrate our common grief. And that is so important today, that everyone is grieving, but no one knows what to do with it. And being able to grieve in ritual and with others is extremely important to do the emptying, but also the empowerment that comes after that emptying.
Yes.
And then to build up our creativity and our common work, all that can be energized by ritual.
Yeah. And, you know, as you've worked with, you developed this cosmic mass, and, you know, I've, as you mentioned, been working with chanting, and many people over the last 30 years, you know, chant some of the Aramaic words of Jesus in small meditation groups, like taizé music, things like that, and then, you know, try to go more deeply into the sort of the shared experience that, you know, Jesus, Yeshua, in his Aramaic name, is pointing us towards. So let's talk a little bit about Cosmic Christ. Tell us a little bit about Cosmic Christ, Matt, and what that means to you.
Yes, and just to build on what you just said, the very first time that you led us in a prayer of the circle dance of the Abun Dabash Maya, the Our Father, something happened for me. Christ showed up in the middle of the circle. I mean, that's not happened often when I pray, nor do I seek for it, but it happened. It was really an amazing thing. So I knew from then, that moment on, that your work was more than useful. It was profound. Okay. So what's the question you asked?
Cosmic Christ.
Okay, let's get the answer. Okay. Well, the Cosmic Christ is the most profound and foundational archetype of the Christ and of mysticism itself in Christianity. Remember that Christianity flies on two wings, the wing of the historical and Aramaic Jesus and the wing of the cosmic Christ. Now, one thing that's so important about the cosmic Christ today is that the Nicene Creed, which is a fourth century creed, which Anglican churches and Roman Catholic churches and several others still recite by rote on Sunday mornings very often. That was a fourth century thing. And it was filled with Greek philosophical terms, and fine, it was done in Greece. Why wouldn't it be? But it's limited, and it was inaugurated not by a Christian church as such, but by the Emperor Constantine. So that makes it just a little bit fraught as well. But that's reality, and that's hung around for 16 centuries. But the Cosmic Christ Christology began with the earliest writer in the Christian Bible, with Paul. Mm-hmm. In Colossians, for example, but other examples as well. I'll just remind you of the one writing in Colossians, the Colossians 1, 15 to 17. Christ is the image of the unseen God and the firstborn of all creation. For in him were created all things in heaven and on earth, everything visible and everything invisible. Before anything was created, he existed, and he holds all things in unity, holds all things in unity. That unity that is, as we say, falling apart everywhere today. But it's an archetype of the pattern that connects. And so it's, now another thing is, people today, if they hear about it at all, because the church has not been preaching it for centuries, they say, oh, well, that's something Teilhard de Chardin came up with in the 20th century, and it's New Age or something. No, it's straight from Paul, the first writer in the Christian Bible. And the Gospel of Thomas, which is also very old,
right,
it's in there too. But then again, as we're going to show later, it's in all the great events depicted in all the Gospels, from the Nativity to the crucifixion and resurrection and everything in between. So it's everywhere, and yet we haven't talked about it for centuries. We've been so busy going after that historical Jesus that we've forgotten the sense of the cosmos. And that's part of our anthropocentrism, that we're only interested in someone who looks like us and who talked to us. But we leave out the cosmos, which is leaving out the earth. As Thomas Berry says, ecology is functional cosmology. Yeah. So if we can recover a cosmology, with that comes a living ecology. And so the cosmic Christ stands for the sacredness of all beings. So John 1, it has a cosmic Christ and talks about the light in all beings. And now today's physics talks about how there are photons in every atom in the universe. So all 2 trillion galaxies contain this light, what Eckhart calls the spark of divinity that's in all beings. So this is opening our minds and heads and bodies up to the sacredness of the universe and the sacredness of the earth and the sacredness of all beings on the earth, including ourselves. Yep. And this, of course, is a revolution in consciousness. So, and Thomas Berry says, we'll not recover the lost sacred without recovering a sense of the universe. And so the cosmic Christ brings us there. Now, one other point. When I was in South Korea lecturing a few years ago, I brought up the cosmic Christ, of course. And afterwards, a Buddhist monk came up to me and he said, I've never heard that term cosmic Christ before, but I love it. I'm going to start preaching about the cosmic Buddha. And of course, he should. Because the cosmic Christ is utterly ecumenical. We're all part of the cosmos. We're all part of the earth. And of course, the Buddha nature that Thich Nhat Hanh writes about is absolutely parallel to the cosmic Christ in Christianity. And in Judaism today, scholars are coming up with re-understanding the term shalem, that means we translate as image of God. Yeah. And they're realizing in the entire Jewish tradition, the image of God is not just about humans, it's about every being is an image of God. That, my folks, is the cosmic Christ in Judaism.
Yeah, as you've pointed out, and I have also in my books, this does reach back to the story, the cosmology story in Genesis, where it's in Genesis 1, 26, 27, it talks about that the human being is being created in the Tselem, which is what you mentioned. It is the image, but it's not a picture image in ancient Hebrew. It's not a picture of someone or something. It's a moving image. Mm. It's like a shadow that moves in response to, you know, a source of light. Mm. So another way of translating it is sometimes the, you could say the depth of this embodiment. And it's important to note that it is moving. We are each moving individually. Different beings move individually with this divine, as you would say, as Buddhists call it, the Buddha nature. So it says, Nahase Adam Bitsalamenu, Nahase Adam Chide Mutenu. This is in the likeness. So people want to make this, okay, it's only about Jesus. It's just the picture of Jesus. It's only about Jesus, but it's not about Jesus in Hebrew or in John 1, because John 1 is also stated, again, I don't want to get too much into the technicalities of the language, but John 1 is really stated as in the beginning is, in the first point of the beginning is living. It's not it was, but it is. At the point that it of the creation, it is living as word, that is, as sound. And if we look to the book of Sirach, which is one of the books, sort of intertestamental books, as is pointed out, word is related with wisdom, that is, holy wisdom, chokhmah. Sophia is her, aka Sophia, her better known name. Which people know her by today. So people were awaiting at that time, at the time that Jesus comes, Yeshua comes, they were awaiting a figure that would bring them all together, that would redeem them from, you could say, inner and outer, from the desperate situation they had been at that time. And here one can mention, you know, also a political situation, is that the people of that particular area had been under the thumb of empires for centuries. And so there was this expectation, as we witness in these intertestamental books, that some figure would come. And so you might ask, well, how can Jesus, a man, embody Sophia, a woman? Well, ancient peoples at that time did not have this fixed idea of maleness and femaleness. Because again, if we reach back to Genesis, it says that the first human being, one human being, is created male and female. So we're already envisioned in this story in Genesis 1 to have a kind of a melded dual nature of maleness and femaleness and a flow between them. And it's not an either or thing. This goes on throughout the whole biblical tradition, and I will say from my more recent research, also into the Quran, which we're not talk about much here today, but they have the same, basically the same story. They inherit the same stories from the Abrahamic tradition of this, you could say, the divine nature of the human being, the Tsalem, the depth of, you could say, reality, knowing itself in the human being. So, let's go a bit more into the I Ams, Matt, and proceed from there, because I think these give a, you could say, a more concrete, a practical view to how different this view is, your view, my view, Cosmic Christ, Aramaic Jesus, of these statements, which are often viewed as simply exclusivity statements. Well, it just means Jesus, you know, so we have to, Jesus is going to save us. How, you know, and so it's just Jesus, you know, I have to believe thoughts about Jesus. I have to have certain beliefs about Jesus. Then that will, so to speak, save me. So what's your view of that?
Right. Well, to build on what you were just teaching, what's at stake here is the realization that we are all other Christs. And that flips things. So, for example, if is in the Gospels where the I Am saying, and of course, I Am is a name for the divine in the book of Exodus, when Moses asked God, who shall I say I'm speaking to? I am who I am, or I am who I will be. And Neil can surely embellish that through the Aramaic. But the point is that the I Am is the sacred name for divinity. And yet we're all called to that I Am. So if we find a phrase like I am the door, what that means is you are the door. In what ways are you a door? And this gets really practical. In what ways is Christ a door? Fine. Is Jesus a door? But in what ways are you a door? And am I a door? And are we living up to being doors. and of course, a door can be a very positive thing. It could be a welcoming thing. It opens and it shuts. It creates intimacy when it shuts, but also it can be barred and locked. And so even with these images, there are choices to make. Are you going to be, you know, a healthy door that, and are you going to welcome strangers? Or are you going to just keep people at bay and so forth? So this can apply to every one of these archetypes, and they are archetypes that are attributed to Jesus or the Christ. In what ways are we adored to one another? And you can turn every one of these I am sayings around that way, including, of course, Matthew 25. I do it to the least, you do it to me.
Yeah.
And right there, the historical Jesus is talking about the cosmic Christ. And he rarely does that. But he's saying that I am this person. I'm not just me. So we are one another, especially when we're in trouble, when we need help. And so there's a whole ethics that is built on Matthew 25, where we're here to help one another and find the Christ in one another.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, as you say, this Matthew 25 part, you know, this we find throughout the tradition, really, because it's the interconnectivity that happens when we view this, when we not only view, but we experience this in ourselves, then we feel, okay, as the Jewish tradition says, and as repeated later in the Islamic tradition, if you save one human being, you save all of humanity. If you kill one human being, you're killing all humanity. This is about the ancient notion that we are interconnected. This is this interbeing that Thich Nhat Hanh talks about too, again, to quote a Buddhist. Now, you know, one thing I'll say about the I am, and we can use that as a short form of what we're talking about, but wait for it. Aramaic doesn't actually have a being verb. Mm-hmm. That is, it doesn't have I am, you are, he, she, it is, they are. It doesn't have the are, the is. This is true throughout the ancient Semitic languages. The first verb, that is, the first activity, is to live. So all this has to do, when you see this sometimes, for instance, in Exodus, where Moses is confronted by the burning bush, what he hears the burning bush really saying in Hebrew, and this is, there's all sorts of different interpretations about this, so I don't want to get into an argument with anyone on the chat about this either. He's really, this is based on the verb for livingness, that which lives, which is living, past, present, future, is what is speaking to you. It is life, it is livingness. And so when Jesus, however, in Gospel of John, it's translated as I am. What he actually says in Aramaic is two of the Aramaic words, ina, I-N-A, I-N-A. So he says, ina, ina. Ina or ena means I, that is the individual. So he says, ina, ina, connecting my ego, my individuality, to the source of that. Connecting my self, my individual self, to the source of that. Well, how does that make any sense? Well, you have to know, again, words that are mistranslated throughout the Gospels. Soul, self, and breath, and all of these are mistranslated often. The basic cosmology that Jesus has, and which was true in the biblical times, is that we have two different types of breath. One is an individual breath that I hold within this body for however many years I've got in time and space here. And the other is a breath that is always connected, always connected. And based on these two words for breath, we have the word for the individual self, nafsha in Aramaic, N-A-P-H-S-H-A, if you want to spell it out, and rucha, rucha, Hebrew is ruach. Hebrew of the individual self is nefesh. So once we understand this basic map, that there we have two ways of looking at life, and one is our always-on, open 24/7 connection to that which was before and which comes after, and one is our individual life as we try to manage as best as possible right here in time and space and muck our way through and mess things up and then get things, some things right. So it depends on being able to turn from, you could say, the ina, my individual I, to the source of that. You could say, you could call it soul. But again, throughout most translations of the Gospels, the word self and soul are translated all higgledy-piggledy, as they say here. It's all messed up. And then the breath is often translated as spirit, so people think it's somewhere God knows where, or goddess knows where. Whereas wherever you see the word spirit in the New Testament, you can read the word breath. Just read the word breath, because it has to do with my breath connecting to our breath, again, interconnectivity, and then that breath, our planetary breath, which is very important, connecting to the source of that. And that's what he calls, wait for it, holy breath, or Rucha de Kudsha, or you could say sacred breath. So this is this connection, you see, that becomes very, very clear once we start to just shift a few things, correct a few mistranslations, and then correct some of them that are very, very limited, such that we don't see what the heck is going on, if you excuse me for saying. I was raised Christian. You know, I was raised in a Christian household. I memorized large parts of the King James Bible, not as part of my household, but as part of my elementary school education. I had to memorize all of Luther's Small Catechism. It was good for the memory, but it was like rote, as you're talking about, Matt. It was rote. But, you know, some of it stuck with me, and then I was able to reframe it. What about this first one? You know, it's usually considered the first. It's not really the first, but the one in John 6, Matt, where Jesus says, I am the bread. I am the bread of life, he says. What's your take on that one?
Sure. That, again, I think it's so interesting that Jesus picks so ordinary a image, an experience as bread. And of course, bread is foundational for survival in the Middle East, as it is in many, but not all cultures. It would be like rice in Asia. And we have to translate that too, you know. So what is rice to Asians? What is bread to Western cultures? Well, it's survival. And of course, it comes up often in Jesus' teaching. The Our Father, give us this day our daily bread. And so it's about work, isn't it? It's about people have to grow the grain, and they have to, you know, the sun has to come and the rain has to come, and not too much of either one, which we're experiencing under climate change today. We're getting either floods on the one hand or droughts on the other. So there has to be this balance. And then human ingenuity has to pound the bread and pound the wheat and turn it into flour, etc. And of course, add some leaven and all the rest. So it's a process. It's creativity on humans' part. It doesn't just drop out of the sky, although we're told, of course, that in the Hebrew Bible, there was a special bread that did drop out of the sky and kept the Jews alive in the wilderness. So it's just filled with archetypal power. But to say, I am that, I am the bread, and then to turn it around and say, you are the bread. How are we bread for one another? And how are we sustenance for one another? And I think that brings up all kinds of issues around justice and injustice, around, and of course, climate change. I was just talking about that, about our interdependence with nature. And so I think all of that is in the mix. When the Christ says, I am the bread, and meaning also, we are bread to one another. But I'll let you, Neil, now take it further.
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it's, again, we have a parallel way of viewing this. If you look at the Aramaic, that, again, if we take ina as the connection of my small self, you could call it, to the source of myself, connecting self to soul, you could say, which is done by turning the heart. The heart has to turn, is the way they would look at it. Then this connection, ina, he says, lachma dahai. This is the food, because actually in Aramaic, even though it does mean bread, it isn't limited to bread per se. wheat-free, gluten-free, or whatever. It really is a, it's food. So this is the food of freshness that is of livingness. De chai, or chai, is this livingness. Well, what is it that we eat in food? Well, we call a food fresh when it has a lot of life in it. And so we are, as you point out, Matt, we are this food. I mean, our bodies become food for those who come after us. So, and then what about our souls? You know, are these fresh? Are we always renewing our soul? Are we changing? Are we stuck in our ways? Are we always looking for more? Looking for more, you could say, from our soul, rather than trying to grasp more possessions or this or that on the outside, which is what's done so much damage to the climate. Now, there's an interesting story around this, and I'll just share it very briefly in John 6, and that this phrase, Inana Lachma Dahai, I am the bread of life, happens in the aftermath of the story where Jesus has done one of his big feedings. You remember the story, bunch of people come, there's no food, there's a few loaves and fishes and like that, and you know, they feed everybody. Well, it's a big happening, as we would say today. So Jesus and his students, his disciples as they're called, Yeshua, they go out on the boat, they fish some, then they come back. I'm shortening the story, and the crowd is still there, and the crowd is basically saying, hey, what about more loaves and fishes? You know, we're still hungry. And it's at this point that Jesus says, you know, okay, don't look for the outerness, don't look for the materialness, look for that freshness within yourself. I mean, he's not saying starve yourselves, but he's saying what you're really looking for is the food that will give you this livingness, that will connect you to the life that is interconnecting us with the planet and with our source. And, you know, this is where he also has this very controversial saying where he says, unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you won't understand what the heck I'm talking about. I'm translating loosely from the Aramaic, and then the disciples say, you know, Master, that's a very difficult saying. They're not getting this. The crowd is dispersing, which is probably what Jesus wanted anyway, because they were looking for the outer. And isn't that just what's happening today? You know, all these soul impulses that we have, we look for them in, you know, for this unlimitedness in the outer. Whereas, again, when I looked into this more deeply, all the words for happiness or joy in Aramaic, they have to do with noticing that our small self, our individual self, has limitations. We can't consume as much resources, you know, as we each want. We can't acquire as much wealth as everybody wants. You know, the limitation of our individual humanity is necessary to find the unlimited. Why? Because then we turn from acquiring things outwardly to the connection, you could say, with soul, with the cosmic Christ, with what is always on and open 24/7. And, you know, that's sort of where he starts to go with all of this.
Mm-hmm. And another angle on the I am the bread of life and the crowd being hungry, as people say, and the inner work that you talk about, the inner self is opposed to the outer, is that generosity is found inside too. And so part of what he may have been doing was urging people to share the bread, not hoard their bread. You know, they just brought a little picnic for them, their own family, but others were there with no picnic. So,
yeah.
So that may well have been part of the story too, that he got people to dig in and think of others.
Absolutely.
And break your bread and you eat a little less, like you were just talking about, and your neighbor gets to eat too.
And that's a miracle too.
That's a bigger miracle.
You could say that again. Anyway, can we do a little bit of chanting here before we go go further? And we just have a brief sort of pause for contemplation. I think that's helpful. And I'll grab my guitar here, just so you have a sense of old time's sake here, Matt. So we're going to chant this one that Natalia just put into the chat, which is Inanna Lachma Dehai. If you look there, you will see it a couple of times. And this is, again, connecting our individual self to that which is, you could say, more permanent, to the cosmic Christ, to the livingness within us. And feel the, and we'll, then we'll pause for a brief moment of silence and feel that connection to life, not only within us, but around us, because it is the same life, as Matt was pointing out, in nature, in all beings, as the Buddhists would say. All right, here we go. So chant a little bit with me. If you want to move, you can, you know, I'm just going to lean back and forth here because we can't do much more than that on Zoom, but we can still enjoy life.
Inanalah madahai. 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 Inanalah madahai.
Now just feeling our own breathing connecting to life within us, around us, what is always living. If you don't remember the Aramaic words, just breathing, feeling, okay, my life comes from before the before. I'm here for this period of time. What is mine to do? And then it continues on. If we connect with that source, Ina, Ina, small self, to that which has empowered, created, that which is doing everything.
I have a question for you, Neil.
Amen.
That small self, you could also say its other expression is the big self, the big self. And psychology uses that a lot today. Jungians certainly use it a lot. But I think what they mean is our interconnectivity with all being and with the source of all being, when you know, the big self, the self of the capital S. So that might be another way of talking about that translation, you say self.
Yeah, different people translate these terms soul and self different ways, particularly in modern psychology. Jung talks about individuation, which is really, if you read Jung very, very closely, say as Peter Kingsley has done in his books, Jung is really talking about the same thing, particularly in his book Answer to Job. It's this connection. You could say individuation is really this connection of my limitedness to my unlimitedness. We won't even have to use the word soul and self. But anyway, one has to use something for the sake of translation, as I point out in the new book. Well, Matt, let's go into this thing about the light. This is another theme. I am the light of the world. These different sayings that are in John 8, most of which has to do with themes of light, really. What's your take on that one?
Well, in my study on world religions, where I have 18 themes that are common to all of them, the word light really stands out. What I found is that the word light is the closest synonym for divinity around the world. Buddha says that become a light unto yourself. And of course, Jesus talks about not hiding your light under a lamp, and the Christ talks about, I am the light of the world. And but you find this language, this metaphor for light, for divinity, everywhere. And of course, it's understandable. We all know, all people know everywhere and have known that, the sun coming up is kind of helpful and useful and bottom line. And especially people living in the north, Ireland or Northern Canada is the worst, or Iceland, where my brother lives now, and his wife, she's from Iceland, that you really honor light when you have a situation where you have 20 hours a day of darkness. So, and of course, then there's so many meanings to light. And of course, Genesis 1 says light was the first thing created, but so does the new creation story of science, that the fireball was the first 750,000 years of our universe. Yeah. And so Einstein himself said, I want to spend my whole life doing nothing but studying light. So light is a name for the divine. There's one of the wonderful Psalms says, God comes robed in a cloth, in a robe of light. So light is everywhere when you're talking about divinity, and not just in the biblical tradition, but around the world. So for Christ to say then, I am the light, and saying that we are to be light to one another, which he literally says. And of course, in the Celtic tradition, light is identified with our intelligence, with, our mind lighting up and your heart lighting up. And so what can you say except that light is a primal effort by humanity to name what divinity is?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it goes way, way back in our human heritage, not just in our material heritage, but in the evolution of our consciousness. One thing I just, Semitic languages, the ancient Semitic languages, really stem from a time before agriculture. So when the ancient Semites were wandering, and so light then becomes for these people clarity. During the day, you can see things. At night, I don't see very well. And so it's really about clarity, seeing clearly, and, at a time, okay, then this is in the dark, it's in the unknown. It doesn't mean darkness is evil. So you don't have this light is good, darkness is evil dichotomy or split in these ancient cultures, particularly in the ancient Semitic languages. And this is true for Jesus too. So this light is really about, as you were pointing out, that the Celtic Christianity has it, this clarity that we have. Okay, we're in a world full of confusion. Can I get clear on what is really mine to do in all of this? Or am I going to be so paralyzed that I'm going to, be in a sort of a muddle of paralysis that I don't really see very clearly? So this is what Yeshua keeps pointing to in the Gospels, and particularly in this John 8 passage, which happens really just after this whole sort of pregnant moment, if you excuse the expression, where they do this test of Jesus, of Yeshua, and they bring him this woman supposedly caught in adultery, as it's called. And they say, well, we're supposed to stone her, so what do you say, master? And yada, yada, yada. And then what usually is overlooked is that Jesus starts to write something in the sand in front of them. We don't find out what it is. And he says this famous saying, which everyone remembers, those without sin cast a first stone. Sin really means those without their own tangles in their past life. Because really sin is about tangles. We've done things in our life that got us into tangles. You could like knots. So Jesus says, those who don't have their own tangled life, you know, cast the first stone. And then he starts to write in the sand or in the earth. And gradually they fade away. And the gospel makes a point of saying that it's the oldest ones first, because we don't know. Maybe he's writing, well, so-and-so did this and you did that. And what about these things that you did? And, you know, so the oldest ones have more to hide than the younger ones. So they start to troop out. And then he goes into this, you know, Inanna Nuhre de Alma. I am the light of all the levels, because Alma is really, there are different words for earth or world in Semitic languages, and Alma or Alam really means the light in time that allows us to see and know things in time and space. We distinguish things, we learn things, we know things. So the light that allows us to know practically in our lives what's going on, who's telling the truth and who's making stuff up, that these levels or this condensation of levels, this light, if you connect, then you'll know who's telling the truth and who isn't telling the truth. You know, they used to say that you can't lie, you know, you can't lie to children and dogs. I don't know if anymore it's true, but I mean, if you put a dog or a child in front of a TV set and troop a politician in there, you know, the dog's probably going to start to bark. But anyway, so the understanding, the light of how to distinguish, you could say, even on this level of time and space, that which is true from that which is not true. What is true for me in my life? You know, where is the compass that is going to direct me towards my next steps? You know, and what is, you know, maybe what is not for me? This is one of the most important questions in life, is the question of our human purpose. And Jesus keeps trying to point people to this. It's a remarkable chapter if you read John 8 in the Aramaic, because, you know, then, as I say, it's all about seeing and not seeing. Then, you know, along the way, he heals this blind man, but, you know, oops, it's the Sabbath, so he shouldn't be healing anyone, because some people think healing someone is work, and he shouldn't be working. And, you know, eventually he ends up before the scribal council in the Jerusalem temple. And they're asking him, you know, so what gives you the right to do this? And, you know, our fathers didn't do this. And, you know, da, 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 da. You know, we've never done things this way. I mean, isn't this the way, you know, we always hear now when people go on about, well, we've always done it this way, you know, and so it's always got to be this way. But actually, it's not true. It's just, you know, it's a fiction that human beings have always done things the way we now do them, isn't it? I mean, really, it's amazing.
Yeah, if I could just add a little footnote to this too. As you were talking about light and the Aramaic language that preceded agriculture and so forth, how important light was and about clarity, it reminded me of an interaction I had with Eddie Nebo, an Aboriginal in Australia. And it was nighttime, and he said, you know, in daytime, clarity is about the things we're interacting with. We see one another, we see the earth, everything around us. But nighttime, it's dark on earth, but the sky lights up. Then we see the stars, but of course they're always there, but you don't see them in the light. You only see them at dark time, at nighttime. Yeah. And then he goes again on and said, you know, in our culture, we teach our children that the stars are campfires of our ancestors, and that our ancestors are looking down at us to see what's cooking here on earth, what kind of campfires, what kind of communities are we creating. But so the wisdom that comes from the night and from the dark, as you said, which is not a negative thing, is different. Nighttime is different from daytime. Now, of course, with electricity and neon lights and cities and all this, we've convoluted this entirely, and yeah, Very confusing. But notice how the cosmology is there. that the cosmos speaks at night, if you will, and the Earth in our everyday life, you know, is happening in the light. But of course, now with Webb Telescope, you know, we are bringing cosmos in a whole new way, right into our living rooms and computers, day and night, and it's astounding, of course, what we're connecting to. It's a marvelous way to connect again to the cosmos. And here again is where the archetype of the cosmic Christ or the cosmic Buddha or others shines.
Yeah, that, I mean, there's every indication also that, you know, the ancient Semitic nomads, they also saw the stars and the planets really as living beings.
Yes.
Because these are all created, you know, before us, you could say, and then the human being comes along. And in one of the most, I would say, egregious mistranslations in all of history, the Genesis passage is translated, be fruitful and multiply and dominate and subdue the earth and rule over. And the Hebrew never says anything about, you know, dominating and subduing. And it doesn't say rule over. It says learn how to manage your individuality, your human self, along with all the other beings created before you, not over. The Hebrew preposition be or bet never means over, that is on top of, in the whole history of the ancient Hebrew language. But it says rule, you learn how to manage all this along with all these other beings of nature, stars and planets that were created before you. So this is again this interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, and it's really all over. But the problem is, you know, all this has been strained out. And as I wrote in one of my early articles, it becomes like a psychic oil that is mined, you know, that is plumbed out of the earth, all this old cosmology of the ancient Semitic tradition of Jesus. So many people are Jesus phobic because the juice of it, the livingness of it, has been strained out and used to create some very toxic theology, frankly. I mean, there's good theology, but there's a lot of very toxic theology in the last 500 years. And, you know, your whole work has been about all this, really. So you know more than I do. It's a thing.
Yeah.
Can we do a little bit? I think let's do a little bit more on, you wanted to get into the shepherd, and you want to do anything more on the shepherd or the doormat or... not the doormat, but the door. I am the door. Or sometimes it's translated, I am the gate, really, and yeah. I am the good shepherd, and like that.
Well, I think the archetype of the good shepherd is really significant for a time of ecological crisis. Because the shepherd, I lived as shepherds for 6 months in the Pays Basque, southern part of France, whereas rented a room in a farm and to write my doctoral thesis. And, you know, shepherding is a project of those at the lower end of the totem pole, because you have to be the shepherds 24 hours a day, and you begin to smell like them. And, you know, you're not developing your social skills so much when you're hanging out with sheep. But sheep are very vulnerable animals. They can't run fast. They can't climb a tree. They don't have good claws or strong teeth. So they really need help. They need parenting and they need protecting. And that's what shepherds do, you know. They're not having to feed the sheep so much or take them to the grasses where they can eat. But they do have to protect them. And especially in a time when wolves were plentiful. And there are some stories about in Jesus' time how at nighttime the shepherds would put the sheep in a shed, and the shepherd would lie down in the entrance to the shed, so that if a wolf came, he'd have to deal with the sheep first, or he'd have to deal with the man first. Or
yeah, the shepherd.
The
yeah.
shepherd first. So, so the shepherd is attached to another being, to another species, and realizes the importance of protecting, of parenting, you might say. That's a big part of parenting too. Yeah. And so I think it's an amazing archetype for our times. And it's not about little Bo Peep, you know, it's not about something sentimental. It's about loving a non-human. And isn't that what the ecological crisis is all about, that we were not even caring for the other than human, whether you're talking fishes or rainforests or polar bears or tigers and elephants. You know, there is, again, we're back to the theme of interdependence.
Yeah.
But I think the shepherd is a marvelous archetype for that. And just because we live in cities doesn't mean that shepherd archetype doesn't speak to us, because it is about protecting the vulnerable.
Yeah. I mean, if you look in the John 9 story, again, from the Aramaic view, you know, Jesus is in Jerusalem. He's caused trouble there. And so you could say the intelligence services of the temple are following him. There's people following him. And then he's speaking to people, and he's sort of speaking to both his listeners who are receptive to him, and he's speaking to these people who are trying to do him no good. And he's talking about, really, when he talks about the gate or the door, he talks about, okay, there are some people who are sneaking in over the back fence, like what we call them sheep rustlers in American English, and they're trying to they're stealing the sheep. And what does that mean? Well, metaphorically, it means that the religious energy, the spiritual energy of people was being hijacked by the temple officials. And this is what gets Jesus in a lot of trouble. And then he says, my sheep know my voice, they hear me, you know, so they hear the voice of authenticity in me, Yeshua is saying. And so they know that I'm telling them, you know, how they can go. This is where it's the so-called good shepherd. It says, ina na rea tauba. So the connection to your own true self, we could use a true self or your small self to the larger self, this directs you to that which is ripe. This is a key word in Aramaic throughout the Gospels, R-I-P-E, not right as in right and wrong, but ripe as in a fruit or a plant ripening. He says, I am the shepherd that leads you to what? The right place at the right time and the right action. This is what ripeness is. Again, if you want to know one thing to read into your Gospels, no matter which translation you're using, you know, wherever you see the words good and bad or like that, you know, you should read ripe, that which is ripe in the right time at the right place, like a fruit ripening or tree ripening, and that which is unripe. And this is what was translated as good and bad. This is why you end up with a good tree and a bad tree. I mean, how is this tree morally bad? Is that even possible? So it's really, he's talking about, he's pointing again to nature. And throughout the, you could say, the Gospels viewed in Aramaic, Jesus is always pointing to nature as a source of teaching. This is a feature, really of his teaching, in a very, very unique way. So, yeah.
And sometimes that word is also translated as perfect. Be you perfect, for example. And I just hate that because Alexander Ronk says perfectionism is a neurosis. Jesus is calling us to be neurotic and perfect, but to be ripe. And as you say, the real meaning of the word.
It's ripe, and it's also ripening. So all of these states of being in Semitic languages and in Aramaic, it's also true. It's not like, okay, now I'm ripe and then I'm done. That's it. Okay, it's all done. No, we're always ripening into life.
Yeah.
And this word that was translated as be you perfect, it's really like a sense of, okay, I'm completing my humanness by connecting to the divine image. Completing. It's an active verb. It's not like, okay, now it's done. It's a static state. Static states are not something that Semitic languages excel in. They're always being, they're sort of active. You know, they're active processes rather than fixed states. And that's actually very important to know, even if you don't know any Aramaic.
And that wonderful teaching of Jesus that follows from this, the things, by their fruits you will know them. You know,
so exactly
what they're saying, you know, that the evidence is in what we're doing, what we're standing for, how we're carrying out our values and our living our integrity, etc. So, yeah.
If we circle back again also to John 1, you know, and cosmic Christ and the light and all of that, towards the middle of this John 1 first beautiful passage, it says, you know, the word that is the wisdom, you could say the light, is becoming, it says, is becoming flesh. So it's becoming living. It's living. And then it's usually translated and dwells among us. So again, this is interpreted as only Jesus. Well, Jesus was here and now he's gone and on and on. But actually the Aramaic says the word, you could say this light that is in all beings, took form, took a form in a human being, and then this is also dwelling within us. So within and among are always the same preposition in Aramaic. So the withinness and the amongness, this is why Jesus is quoted as saying, the kingdom is within you or the kingdom is among you. Actually didn't say kingdom, but that's a subject for another time. But it's always both within and among. So again, this interbeingness. There's only one preposition Aramaic has, and it stands for both within and among. He doesn't have a choice, no matter what he said. I mean, I'm using the scripture that Aramaic Christians use today, but Jesus doesn't have a choice of how many of what words to use, and we know he spoke Aramaic. There's only so many words he could have used. So the withinness, this word, this potential of the cosmic Christ is dwelling within. It's come, and Jesus basically shows us how to do it. That's what he defines as his function. And he shows that really the human potential, not the human potential movement, but the real human potential to realize our light, our cosmic Christ, is still coming. We're still working on it. It wasn't done a long time ago. We're working hard. We hope we get there as a general humanity before we lose the opportunity to get it in these forms, and then, you know, then it'll be up to what Jesus calls Allah, that is the divine, to take things next step. But it's important, you know, again, that we've realized that these are our potentials. This word wisdom, this chokhmah, this holy wisdom, this Sophia that Jesus embodies is really, it's part of each of us. We don't have to reach somewhere out in space for this. Chokhmah, you could say hakima in Aramaic, really means that sense that unites all of our senses. So we know we smell, we touch, we taste, we feel, we have body awareness. But what is it that unites all of these within me so that I can say I smell, touch, taste, feel, rather than just I'm overwhelmed by random chaotic impressions? So this was considered to be the sacred sense, the sacred, we could call it sixth sense, which is another name for holy sense, sacred sense, holy wisdom. It's a potential we're still really, really working on. So
you think intuition would be something of a synonym for that?
I think so, because intuition is a capability that we all have that arises when we do that sort of connection. When we connect, you could say soul to self, we'll use those terms, small self to big self. And then what allows this to happen? Well, our heart has to turn. It has to be, you know, it's like we have to take the rust off our heart, as Jalaluddin Rumi says, so that the heart can turn from the individual and the material to that which is, you could say, always on. And it doesn't mean the material and individual isn't important, because these are our challenges, but we have to be able to turn so that we're not just one, just focused out on what's, you could say, out there, but also what's in here. And that's my take. What's your take on that, Matt?
Well, the reason intuition came to my mind is, you know, Einstein says that we've been given these two gifts, the gift of the rational brain and the gift of the intuitional brain. and that values come only from the intuitional brain. But he says, I abhor American education. He criticizes education because it values only the rational brain, which has no values to it. He says the rational brain should serve the intuitive brain. And of course, the intuitive brain includes heart, which you're talking about, changing the heart. It includes conscious, it includes connection to the whole, the cosmos, therefore, the capacity for wholeness, which is intrinsic to all of wisdom. And it includes play, which is part of wisdom, and creativity. So all these good things tend to be ignored in everyday education in the West in favor of, you know, the rational. And so finding that balance again, I hear you really talking about that when you're talking about changing the heart and wisdom, changing the heart. And of course, wisdom is also feminine. Chokmah, Sophia, Sapienza, around the world, Kuan Yin over my shoulder here, she's feminine. So that's been banished for the last 400 years of modernity. And so we have knowledge factories, but we don't have wisdom schools. And so I think all this kind of comes together in what you're talking about when it comes to wisdom and Jesus' teaching of wisdom and how the kingdom, queen of God is among us and within us. And wisdom is among us and within us. And that Christ is wisdom. And as you said earlier, that melds the masculine and the feminine. So anyway, I just think there's a lot that follows from what you were just talking about.
Well, we're about at the end here. I mean, we could go on and on quite a bit, actually, but maybe we end very briefly before we say thanks to everybody with just a little bit more chanting of the first line of Jesus's prayer, which you mentioned earlier, Matt, when we were dancing together in the 80s in ICCS in Oakland. So we're going to chant just a little bit of Avun Dibash Maya, which Natalia has just put in her chat. So refrain from chatting for a moment so people can see that. And again, Avun is not a being sitting somewhere in judgment of us. It is, again, a living process. I originally wrote, O Breathing Life of All. That's probably the closest. But if we want to talk about it, it's the process of giving birth, of parenting, that is throughout the universe, that is throughout the realms of light and connectivity and vibration, which is what Shemaya actually is in the ancient Semitic languages. So Yeshua's, you know, pointing beyond himself, beyond any particular image of God or goddess, to that which is potential within all of us, that which is, you know, really authentic within us, because authentic means that which is creating, that which allows any individual to create something, and that comes from this same source. Anyway, here we go. We're on the track, and so a lot more could be said there, but let's chant a little bit and then breathe together, have some silence, and we'll say goodbye. Avun Dibash Maya, 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 Avun Dibash Maya. Just breathing, connecting to our individual source, whatever we call that. Connecting to the bigger community around us, community of nature, of the planet. breathing in, breathing out. Feeling our hearts more flexible, more capable of turning from our individual challenges in life, connecting to the source from which we come, that divine image, the cosmic Christ, is always present in every being, no matter what you call it. Amen, amen, amen. Okay, I think we just about made it. So thanks to everybody. Thank you, Matt, for being so generous with your time. Thanks to Natalia, for doing our engineering here. And thanks to all of you also who are listening on the recording, because I know many of you will be doing that. And remember that whenever, even if you're listening on the recording, you can just feel that you're here now, because ancient Semitic languages, they don't have a strict separation between past, present, and future. The now is always now. Anyway, thank you. Many thanks to Matt, and thanks to all of you for joining us. And we'll see you somewhere.
For your inspiration in having this event, and good luck with your new book. And blessings on everybody. May you all be inspired by the implications of our 15 minutes together today. So be well, wherever you are.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Matt. Take care, everybody. Bye for now.